Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every single week. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days as a warm ear hug for you. First of all, I was joined by Roddy Collins and Paul Howard. Could barely get a word in as the firm friends talked about their unique dynamic, their irreconcilable differences, how Paul will always have a special place in Roddy's downstairs loo, and of course the day Roddy met Angela Merkel. Later on, we had the hugely funny David Rawl, formerly known as Moonboy, but he's now all grown up. He's 24 years of age, soon to star in The Borrower's Play, which is the winter production at the Gate Theatre in Dublin. He joked about how his schoolmates might have thought he was the sickest child in that school in Ireland when he was secretly shooting the Chris O'Dowd sitcom at the age of just 12. And we end the podcast with super vet Noel Fitzpatrick, all about the incredible connections between humans and dogs in his latest emotional and very funny book, which has great stories, including the one about Frankie the Westie, who landed his very posh owner in the doghouse. And that's everything in the podcast. I'll be back on the wireless as ever next week, RTE Radio 1, 9 until 10. So off we go. They've known each other for years upon years, but collaborating on The Rod Father brought Roddy Collins and Paul Howard even closer. Welcome, gentlemen, studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
To tell us about...
Thanks, Oliver.
Microwave scones, feeding pigeons, and doggy phobia.
Roddy
and Paul.
Doggy.
Roddy, we spoke to you in April. And you were going off to Spain.
I only come back on... Sunday, was it? Saturday.
You've been all that time in Spain?
Yeah.
You have a great life.
Well, do you know what? You only get one of them. You've got one life, so I'm going to make the best of it. And walking around in the sun and drinking glasses of red wine, at lunchtime, and swimming in the evening, beach, you know, going around an overcoat in Dublin.
Can I just say, Roddy sent me a video and he said, oh, the wine over here, it's so cheap, Paul. And I said, really? He said, yeah, have a look at this video. And he sends me a video. He said, what was it? 5 litres for a tenner was what you said, right? And he sends me a video. He's at the back of a truck. It's like a big petrol Bowser. And there's a tap on the back of the truck.
Oh,
and he's filling
God.
A 5 litre can with wine. From
That's true. I have it. I have it on my phone, Oliver.
He was filling a 5 litre can.
I walked into a little off-lush, get a bottle of organic wine. And it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you're going to get a bottle. It says 140. Was it 140 for the bottle? No, when you fill it, it's still only 140.
I said to Roddy, is it any good? And he said, I don't know.
So I'm down with a wheelbarrow now. I have about 7 bottles. I'm telling, where do you go, Rod? I'm going down to get the wine for lunch.
Just
for a big wheelbarrow.
Just send a truck.
A cube behind me. You know, they all got their little bottle that size. I have a big, huge load of bottles. But anyway,
Do you do anything else in Spain?
No. Do you know what I'm doing? I'm trying to extend my life as long as I can. Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah.
Don't watch the telly.
Sure that's
right.
The best.
I only listen to the Oliver Callan show. That's the only show I listen. Yeah, right.
From 10 to 11. 10 to 11 there. Spain time.
No, just basically trying to live stress free. Swimming, walking, going to bed early, and I don't know, it's great. And I do a weekly gloat. My kids put me on air.
A weekly what?
Instagram. The weekly gloat. I call
weekly
it.
Gloat. I thought you were going to say glow up. I was going,
sit on the beach once a week.
Sometimes he sits next to a yacht, by the way, in the harbour. And sometimes he steps onto the yacht and does his Instagram. And that gets tongues wagging. People say, God, you must have made a few bob out of that book.
That's not the thing about it, Paul. This is true. But the kids said, Dad, put your lovely blue shirt on, your white trousers, blah, blah, blah. I'm like a big age and getting dressed up for communion now. And he said, and go down and stand on the marina beside the big blue boat. And I done it. And I come home and I'm trying to convince everyone to do it that I don't own that boat. Right? I don't own the boat. Anyone out there listening? Right? My boat is one beside
the
plastic slide.
He just stole it for a day. That was it. Paul, and you've got it's the last of the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books.
Yeah, Don't Look Back in Hunger.
You were lucky with the title.
The 24. Oh, well, you know, I was absolutely blessed. And like all titles, you know, we decided on it, you know, about a year ago, and you're thinking, is it the right one? And I was thinking maybe it's a bit retro, back to the kind of throwback to the 90s. But Ross started in the late 90s, and his music at that time was Oasis. So I kind of thought it fitted. And the week it came out, Oasis announced that they were getting back together. And they've done very well out of the book, actually. I noticed their ticket sales went through the roof.
Like, that's all from Don't Look Back in Anger.
We had a Don't Look Back in Anger window on Dubray. And when I saw the demand for tickets in Dubray, and I saw the demand for tickets, and I said, that's down to...
Can't believe Rossa Caritelli has driven the entire...
Actually, the reunion happen. Like, good luck to them. Yeah.
Very down to earth.
Don't go on the beer with them.
Roddy...
Roddy, what do you make of the latest book? Have you read it?
I've never read a book in my life, ever. You're a giant book woman. I was in school. Halfway through that.
Roddy definitely read The Rodfather, because the audiobook version, which he narrates, is amazing. And that was one of the reasons we wanted to do this show. As I was writing the book, when we were writing this book, I did maybe 10 hours a day interviews with Roddy. Usually for most subjects, if I was ghosting them, 3 hours is more than I could handle.
Yeah.
And with Roddy, 10 hours at the kitchen table. And then I would go home and I'd transcribe the interviews and I'd say, these need to be heard. Like, they're fantastic to be read. They're funny to be read. But really, they need Roddy's voice. And he did it with the audiobook. The audiobook, people who've listened to it will tell you, it's absolutely hilarious. But with the live show, it brings it to that
How
further
did you stop
degree.
Him drifting doing the audiobook?
Well, I didn't record it, but Paul Feegan, who records all the audiobooks for Penguin, called me and told me, this stuff is absolute dynamite. But Roddy went through torture doing it because he thought he had to read it.
I thought it was the biggest punch in the class. I did, honestly. Yeah. Because I kept breaking down. You know, I kept breaking down on it. Like, you have to read it off in audio. And I was, like, I'd say, how are you, my old pal?
Yeah, yeah.
How are you, my old friend? Or something.
Oh, I see what you
like
mean.
That.
Yeah.
So it was different stuff like that. And I jacked up twice.
You walked out. He was sent down. Paul Lewis of Coolock. And no, he didn't walk out. Paul's a great guy. He would have made a good football manager, actually.
Yeah. You
know? He's like sending Roddy, his star player, go for a walk down to the Northside shopping centre. There's a pizza place in there. Go in and have a slice of pizza and come back. And Roddy did it. And really, you know, I said to Paul, you know, this needs to be Roddy's authentic voice. You know, I tried to capture the authentic voice in the book, but when he's reading it, you don't need to pronounce every hard T, and you don't need to say, how are you? You can say, how are you? Yeah. And that's what you did in the end. And the audio book, I mean, I know the story. I know all the stories inside out. And I still would throw the audiobook on in the car and I laugh at every single story. You know, the story about the roast chicken, the story about Portadown, the story about you telling Caroline you won the lotto, the story about you teaching the travellers bare knuckle boxing. I mean, this is...
Did you kind of go home thinking, how am I going to research any of these stories? There'll be no documentary evidence that anything happened.
Well, the hilarious thing is probably, I think you said in your introduction earlier, Oliver, there's 200 stories in the book. And when we do these shows, Roddy will tell a story that I haven't heard before. And backstage, I'm just sitting there looking, I'm smiling. But inside, I'm thinking, why didn't you tell me that?
Yeah. But this is happening regularly, even when I'm sitting in my car. He's going, Rod, why'd you never tell Paul that story?
Yeah.
Why does that one not in the book and all that?
Yeah.
But look, since the book finished, there's been a million new stories, you know. Yeah. Lots of good things have happened since, and a few mad things as well. But doing the audio one was the toughest thing. And it was a four-day job.
Four days.
That took 8 days.
It took 8 days.
Yeah, no, it stretched out too. But I thought I was getting paid per day, and I kept purposely, I dragged out, and Paul Finkel gone, Rod, come on, please.
I said to Roddy, you're not plastering anymore.
And also, Paul said that Paul Finkel did say, go and have a walk. That wasn't what persuaded me to go back in. I ran car and says, you get back in there now. Okay, I'm sorry.
You talk about actually writing the process of writing the book in the show, don't you? Because going to those meetings were important. Because Caroline, I believe, is Roddy's wife.
Yeah,
is a big fan of yours.
Oh, well, that's very nice. I mean, I'm a big fan of Caroline's. I've known Roddy and Caroline for about 34 years, and I covered Roddy's brother Stephen's boxing career.
Yeah, yeah.
So I travelled the world. on a shoestring. Like I had no money. I was a freelance journalist and I'd be covering a fight for 5 or 6 papers. So I'd be in like Atlantic City, New Jersey, New York, Meadowlands, Italy, Spain, everywhere, Hong Kong. Yeah. And I looked very, very young when I was 20. You know, I was young. I was 19 maybe. And,
yeah, but you looked about 12.
And I looked about 12 and I had these round glasses.
The Milky
and
Bar
they
kid.
Knew
that
me as the Milky
nickname.
Bar kid. That's what they say. Yeah. Anyway, Caroline, we're sitting in the hotel lobby one night and Caroline said to Roddy, "Who's that young lad over there?" I said, "That's the Milky Bar kid. That's the boy reporter who covers all of Steve's fights." She said, "He should be in bed, like, you know. It's like 2 a.m.
He should be in bed."
Caroline sent Roddy over to tell me to go to
bed. I went down, pausing and say, "Go up to bed, you. It's 3 o'clock in the morning." He said, "I don't have a bed." I went back to Caroline and says, "The kid has nowhere to sleep." Caroline says, "Well, get him up." So we used to get upgraded to
the suite in Vegas.
So I pulled this mattress off the bed, put it in the corner, put the Milky Bar kid over there, and we'd be on the base. And then after that, wherever we went there, we'd book a room. All the lads mostly would go, and we'd book a room, and Paul was part of the booking of the room. Where are we going to fit the Milky Bar kid? Get him into that cot over in the corner there, you know. And that was it. And then when Paul made and became real famous and everyone claimed, "Oh no, he stayed in my room, he stayed in my room." Instead,
I can confirm I stayed in Roddy and Caroline's room.
You reckon he became posh then with success, is that right,
Oh,
Roddy?
You're having a laugh. Hello.
this is Paul Howard for Ballybrack.
Paul Howard drank lager with us in England and then suddenly I was in Lily Bardello's one night, hadn't seen Paul in years, and a bottle of champagne came over, and as when Stephen was the champ, people used to take, you know, recognise me and think I'm Stephen, and I'm going, "Tell them I'm not Stephen, I don't want the champagne." I look over and there's Paul waving over. He's cracked it.
What happened was Bono sent the champagne over. I intercepted it and said, "Bono, I'll take that."
"Well, your friend from Darky, huh?" Like when I went down to Darky to see Paul, the RNLI was sent out, the helicopter. I took a picture beside the monument, you know, the big marble monument, whatever it is, and I said, "Paul, I'm out in Dunleary, are you around?" And he straight back says, "Don't tell anybody you know me." And I was trying, we're doing a show and talking, and I wanted to find out, because I'm thinking, no one knows me out there, no one knows me anywhere. But I'm thinking, no one's going to turn up. So I was going down, "How are you, Head? How are you, pal? What's crack, all right?" And nobody recognised. Looking at me, "Who's this yahoo over here this side of the town?" Then the RNL, I was expecting the loudspeaker, "North side yahoo, please get back on the train."
You would swear Roddy hasn't been anywhere further south than, what, Westmoreland Street?
Well, I didn't think there was any further south than Meade Street.
Have you tried to say hello to people on Westmoreland Street as well?
The south side to me was Westmoreland Street and Meade Street. That was it. I thought it was all countryside after that, you know. But when I got to Dog,
Game of Thrones,
that was posh.
This was Dorky Book Festival, was it?
We were at the book festival, we did an event there and it was great. The way Roddy tells it, he needed subtitles to be understood, but you know, the audience seemed to love you out there. Dorky's a great footballing town as well, you know, and we sold out in Dorky. I think there was about 500 people in there.
It was it went, Oliver, we're doing the book tour, or whatever, I don't know how you title it, and then suddenly we're having the crack. And then we went to Electric Picnic. That turned everything, didn't it? Went to Electric Picnic and you couldn't get into the tent.
Oh, yeah.
And then
yeah.
we got a great recognition. And then after that, MCD come on to us.
We went to Electric Picnic. And like Roddy said, there was hundreds in the tent. People were outside and everything. Yeah. And we finished the gig and I was leaving. And I said, "I see you, Roddy." I was driving back to Dublin. And I heard, as I was walking back to the car park, I heard Roddy singing. What were you singing?
Grace.
No, you were you singing Wonderwall?
Somebody
had dragged him into a tent and somebody come
he's
in and do an interview
through the amp and everything.
And I could hear him going back to the car park. I was like, it's Roddy singing Wonderwall.
Bonus
which
show.
Is completely sums up Roddy's personality, right? I got a flight to Luton with Roddy about 2 years ago. We were going up to do some research for the book and we're on a Ryanair flight, so we didn't pay the extra to be seated together. So I'm sitting at the front and Roddy says, "I see you at the end of the flight." He goes down the back and within 5 minutes I hear this laughter. I turn around and the whole back of the plane is his audience. Like, you know, it's like...
He just talks to everybody.
He wasn't making just one or two people laugh. The whole back of the plane was laughing.
We came
that's
back,
who
we,
he is. You
we
know?
Came back from Spain. I don't do that ticket thing. I love jockeying around. Like, Carla, they'd be up in 6B and I'd be down on 14F.
What do you mean you don't do the ticket? You don't sit where you're supposed to?
I don't pay the extra 15. It's not the money. I just love jockeying around, and I'd say, is that your friend up there yet? Do you want to sit beside your... And I sat beside a fella, right? And his wife was sitting beside Caroline. I was sitting beside him. And I go, is that your wife? Then he says, yeah. And I said, well, that's my wife. He said, well, I swap. And I'll leave her. Jesus, this is going to be a great holiday. That was on their way to Spain on a holiday. I thought he'd say, oh, great, yeah, I want to sit beside me. Because I want to sit.
She's all right, leave her there.
I said, well, I switch and you can sit beside your wife. And I'll leave her. Oh, it's grand, you know. But now, look, I just love talking to people.
He does. Yeah. And when you go out with Roddy, every day is an adventure. Like, we were in Berlin during the summer. We were filming a travel show. We'll say no more about it for now, but we're in Berlin and Roddy's walking down the street and a woman passes him by and he says, oh, how are you, Angela? And the TV crew he was with went, oh God, no. So she shouted, excuse me. And they're like, oh, he's insulted this woman. And they turned around, it was Angela Merkel.
I called her Angela. I swear to God.
So,
what are the chances, right? Roddy Collins and Angela Merkel. And they end up having this chat in the street for about 10 minutes.
I walked out of a restaurant. I was having been doing the bit of film and I walked out. And next while I seen this woman, I said, ah, how are you, Angela? What's the crack? That's exactly what I said. And I put my hand out. I put my hand out, Oliver. And she put her hand out about 6 inches, then pulled it back. And the bodyguard put his hand on the gun. There was two bodyguards. He put his hand on the holster, right? And I went, I'm only saying hello. So,
what did you talk to her about?
The weather, whatever. You know what I mean? How are you keeping? I was ready to say, Rod, how's the boot going? I was ready. I felt insulted. She didn't know me.
It's a pity we didn't have a copy of the Rod.
The two lads, Paul, they looked and said, I said, that's Hangley, Merkel. She said, no. 2 minutes later, she came back up the street.
Go ahead.
And I said, Hangley, I said, we're here, we're tourists, we're doing a bit. And she said, enjoy Berlin. That's what she said.
Yeah, very nice.
And that was it. But yeah.
That's a day in the life of Roddy Collins, by the way.
Seems to be just perfectly normal.
I'm sure she went home and said, I met the Rod family.
You'll never guess who I met.
She didn't even ask me for a selfie. I was raging.
Does the live show have a structure, unlike this interview?
It does. I mean, there's the stories. I say that the Rod father has this cast of characters from George Best, Liam Gallagher, the IRA, Muhammad Ali, the Russian mafia, an English safecracker, a roast chicken, and a doctored birth certificate. And they're just the sort of bare characters of it. But there's probably a set list of about 40 or 50 stories. My favourite is still the roast chicken. And I hope, will you tell it, please, Roddy? Like, it's just... Yeah.
Tell it mentioned twice. Tell
it playing football, very important game. Our best player, pardon me, our best player having an absolute nightmare stinker, as they call it in the game. The manager calls me, find out what's wrong with him. I call him. I go back to defend the corner. And I said, were you out last night? You on the beer? He says, no, Rod. I said, you're having an absolute stinker. What's wrong? He says, I'm at the leaving the chicken in the oven. Like, this isn't cool. I come in and draw. And I went, oh, no. He said, and Jane, was his wife, is in Cork. She's not back till tonight. House going to be burnt to the ground. I goes over. I said, lads, you're not going to believe this. I said, he can't concentrate. He left the chicken in the oven. They got his car keys before the motorway. Back down to the house, come back, game over. He corrected his play, everything was brilliant. Game over, in the shower, walk out. Sister manager walks in with a raw chicken, hammers it across the dressing room. You dope, you never turned the oven on. And that's because the lad that I tell her, he's a raw, why do you keep telling that story? That's a true story.
Yeah.
And he can back that up, you know. But look, people say, are they true? Every single story, is true. Every story is true. Now, there's some Paul left out, which
and
was
Angela
very
Merkel
few.
Angela Merkel can verify some of them.
100%.
Only the TV crew were with us, Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't
have
believed that. No. I didn't tell anyone. They told you. I didn't take anything of it. I forgot about it, actually. No. But, But, look, that's life. Like I walk around Spain. Come as that. That's my thing now.
Yeah,
maybe in. That's all I know. And I can order red wine in Spanish. I'm fluent at ordering red wine in Spanish. But that's it.
From the back of a truck. 5 litres.
Responsibly.
Cool. But the show does have a structure in that, you know, we know the stories and I can really judge from an audience what kind of stories they want, you know. Right. And generally it's... you know, Roddy's managed everybody in the League of Ireland, almost everybody. You haven't managed Pats, but like if it's a Rovers crowd or a Bows crowd, you know, I know to tailor the questions for them. The funny thing is the book starts off, and we always talk about this, the book starts off with Roddy sitting with Caroline in front of the television watching a League of Ireland match on a Friday night, mm-hmm. and the crowd are chanting, Roddy Collins, is a W word, is a W word. And Roddy just says, I hadn't managed for years. The two teams playing, I hadn't managed either of them, but this has just become a chant at League of Ireland matches that they sing Roddy is a W word. And so that's what we start with. But every show starts off with the audience singing Roddy Collins is a W word.
I won't come out unless they sing at the top of their voice.
And it is a feature of Roddy's personality that people who actually thought they didn't like Roddy Collins, when they read the book or when they come to the shows, they realise, actually, this guy is a national treasure. You know, he's got this wealth of stories. He's had this incredibly colourful life. He's an outspoken voice on the game, but also it's the stories, like that bank of stories.
You're talking about structure, Oliver. I was asked to do one on my own. Paul's away, he's out of the country for it, and I couldn't do it.
Really?
No, I couldn't do it.
You have to have him beside you.
I have to have Paul beside me. Yeah.
Rein him in.
You direct him, I suppose, don't you?
You direct him in a way.
The thing is, Oliver, you start talking to me now, we can start talking about those pair of glasses, and we end up talking about something miles down the road. Paul knows when to start reeling the old
I don't. Roddy's great with an audience. The first time I ever saw Roddy in action was 33 years ago in the National Stadium. Stephen was fighting Danny Morgan. Do you remember that fight? And Roddy was in the... We were in the ringside club afterwards. We were having a cup of tea after the weigh-in, and Roddy is at the centre of this group, and he's telling a joke. And the joke was... I still remember the joke, Roddy. Yeah. A fella says to his mate, why do you call your dog Locksmith? And he says... because I gave him a kick in the arse and he made a bolt for the door.
He had an
audience around him, you know, and I think you could do it on your own, asked me to.
I've worked on building sites all my life, and I've been around football environment, dressing rooms, and I love the crack. Yeah. And I love standing up and telling the stories, you know, because like, I'd observe things on the way in, and my imagination would exaggerate the story. I could see something on the way into work, and at 10 o'clock tea, I'd have an audience telling them, and the crack is nutty. And I've been doing it for years. And suddenly Paul says, right, Rod, let me direct you. And didn't even ask, it just developed.
Yeah.
And the book, by the way, it gave you a whole new lease of life.
It changed my life, Oliver.
It actually changed your life.
It did, because there was a narrative out there of Paul says, who I don't socialise. I go everywhere with Carolyn. I don't go into groups, go for beers and golfs and all. Don't do nothing like that. And people have a perception of other people. But I could tell my truth in the book about my career, about my life.
Yeah.
You know, and people realise, hold on a minute, this is what happened at this football club. This is what happened at that juncture in your life. So you're not explaining yourself all the time. And it's just been brilliant. It's been, I have to say, I was walking around at 60 years of age thinking, what was it all about? What did I give my life to football, to everything for? And then Paul called me up and we've done the book. And I thought, Jesus, no one's going to buy that, you know?
Yeah.
And then suddenly I can't even walk, even out in Spain, I'm walking around, people going, Rod, the Rod Father.
And here you are, 2 years on, and it's a live show.
I've never had a book like this that's had a kind of afterlife, like where people, it's sort of still gathering momentum.
People who've read the book still want to hear the story.
Yeah, yeah. The great thing about Roddy, it's such a human story. And Roddy had this burst of fame about 20 years ago when he did a show called The Rod Squad on Satanta. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And, of course you remember
documentary,
that. And he became sort of famous. And a lot of those clips are on YouTube now, and people are kind of discovering them again and loving them again. But what was interesting about when he finished at Carlisle, by the time the show aired, the second season, I think you were gone.
Yeah.
And there's this part of the book where he's back on a building site in Fleet Street the day after he's sacked by Carlisle, and he's plastering, and the lads are hanging over, you know, the scaffolding, shouting at him, you know, I thought you were going to manage Ireland. Yeah. I thought you were going to manage Man United. So it's a very human story. You know, people who watch the Rod Squad, they don't know what happened the day the cameras were turned, the day after the cameras were turned off and everybody went home, that you went back to your real life.
Bro, I did believe I was going to manage Man United. I did believe I was going
to
manage.
You still do. I mean, you said to me about 20 minutes.
I did dream. I played for Man United last week, but it's an actual dream. And the boots were too small and my feet were killing me. And the crowd were all jeering me and all. Like, this is a dream we had, right? So it's maybe I'll play. But
the wide is definitely not good.
It's hallucinating. But like, imagine, Oliver, right? I'm out there and I'm giving it the big I am, going to manage it. And then I'm on a build suit, which I've no problem. We're going to build suit tomorrow. I have to feed the kids, but I want them to build it. And I was tortured. I stuck it till dinner and I just couldn't come on. I says, Carolyn, I'll have to do something else. I can't take the stick. Let it die down.
Ring
for
Paul
a
Howard, let's get a book going.
What is your history with the Ambassador Theatre, which is where this show is going? It was a nightclub. Did you go there when it was a nightclub or something?
I did once, yeah. I went, it was a nightclub. Bad experience that night, but I won't go into that one. Very bad experience that night. Yeah, me and Bonners O'Connor. It was called Romanoff's at the time. And seen a very frightening thing happen in there one night.
Oh,
well, I was only in it one night. I only ever in it once. Will I tell you what happened? Will I tell you?
It's kosher, yeah. Paul looks worried.
Will I tell it, Paul?
No, I won't.
We'll keep it for the show. Stephen opened the Rocky film there with Jerry Creighton of the Zoo. You know, Big Jerry?
Yeah, yeah.
It was the Zoo for RTE, and he boxed with Stephen. So they done a little mock-up boxing match outside for the Rocky film. But now the Ambassador, honestly, Oliver, truthfully, I can't believe this is happening. Honestly.
The people come in and watch a talent story.
I can't believe it.
Yeah,
I mean,
and it's O'Connell Street, O'Connell, you know.
You're going to have to struggle there, Paul.
No, O'Connell Street.
It's for Ballybrack, for God's sake.
Can I just say, Oliver?
No, he's not. Roddy, he's talking now.
Roddy says I'm the poshest fella he knows, well, right?
I start my low Burnham.
The second poshest fella he knows is Brush Shields.
Ventry Park Brush. Good dub. But no, when we were doing a bit of promo for it, yeah, I had to just say, look, everybody on the north side of Dublin, you know, come, it's going to be near Christmas time. Mm. Come, wear your Christmas clothes. We'll have a good Christmas night out. And I said, and everybody from the south of Paul, wear what your mammy tells you to wear. Don't forget to comb your hair.
Our tech system wasn't working great there for a while, but I think it's coming back up and running. But we're going to take a quick break. We come back with some of the messages and loads of other things to ask you. Back after these. Someone says, I love Roddy's book. Listen to it on Audible. Laughed most of the way through. There are very few characters like Roddy left. He's brilliant, says John in Kilkenny. Fans everywhere. Best laugh ever. Love him. Has a fantastic memory, says Roisin in Dunboyne. Someone says, this is an effervescent start to their morning, so thanks to the lads. This person, I worked with Roddy in the 1980s on a building site in Black Rock.
Oh no.
He was such a crack, so endearing. But the work got done. I thought the work never got done.
That was a forced. Eventually.
We might have had to legally edit that one or something. The work was done. Was there anything you might have left out of the book or that you were going to leave out?
There was one mental health issue that was a bit sensitive in the family.
Yeah.
Caroline sat down with our sisters and a whole lot. Well, it was actually Paul who decided to put it in, and everyone was delighted at the end.
Yeah.
You know, because... Yeah.
You handled it very sensitively. You know, it's a family story of schizophrenia, and it was handled so sensitively. And
yeah, well, the whole thing that I highlighted is that the person involved never got the right medication his whole life.
Yeah.
And then eventually at the end, he passed now, but at the end he did. But that was something that was, other than that, I just left it to Paul, to be quite honest with you. And, you know, and there are stories in it that I would have given to Paul and been a little bit, you know, nervous by how Paul manipulated and done up in his expertise, made it look, you know.
No, like nothing was left out because, you know, for any other reason than we just had too much.
I think
it's about 350 pages long. It could have been 3,000 pages. And that's the thing about writing. Writing is all about editing. It's all about cutting back.
And you're brilliant at the rhythm, of course, because you have great crack 1 minute and then there's a life lesson suddenly. So
yeah.
Like that.
And that's what Roddy's life has been like. You know, it's sort of fun and games one moment and then there's something serious to deal with. And, you know, you've dealt with adversity very, very well in your life as well. And that's all part of life story.
But that's the other thing about it. Even your own, when you're reading it, you go through your life, Oliver, right, and you just march on and you group every day and whatever comes, you blah, 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 blah. But when you actually put it down in blocks and look at it, from the time my father passed to Carolyn's father passing, to Caroline having a baby, there was only a period of 4 months.
Yeah, really.
We lost
yeah.
two parents and I had a baby and all, and you look at it, how did we get through that?
Yeah, how did you mentally survive?
Yeah, look, if you were to look forward and say, this is going to happen, you go, oh, what? How are we going to sort this out? But I just believe you get up and march on. As my uncle Roddy O'Rourke always says, Rod, just keep marching on.
Yeah.
That's it. Today is today. Tomorrow's gone. Whatever happened, you can't change it. March on. You know,
and but you're a very positive person. Like you are. Your outlook is positive. Like you're not, you don't get down in yourself and think, oh,
no,
you know,
I don't. Honestly, no. don't. I never. I never.
Wow, what a gift.
I never. Yeah. And it's something people say, like they'd ask me kids, is your dad like that? And I don't wake up negative.
Yeah.
And it's not like one of these, you know, I'm a positive person. I just do what I do. And if I see something, I see the positive in it. Now, if I see, like as someone said, if the roof was blown off the house, I'd say, you grab that corner, you grab it, and we'll hold it till the storm goes by. That's just, thankfully, I got that from my mother, you know.
I used to go to Roddy's house when we were doing the book, and I'd stand outside the door, and the rule was, I'd always knock, and they said, don't be knocking, just come in, just the door's always open, you know. Probably shouldn't say that.
Since I went to Spain, we locked it.
But I'd stand outside the door, and I could hear Roddy and Caroline having the crack in the house through the door. And that just puts you... You put me in good form, Roddy. You really do, like, for the day.
No, I arrived
at the house, I'd be tired and all this, and I just hear this laughter coming from the house. And after how many years of marriage?
Caroline, 47 years together now.
47 years together. And they're still making each other laugh, you know, and still, you know, just...
No, Caroline laughs at me now. She used to laugh with me now.
You love going to the house because I got Caroline did the place up just for Paul.
No. See, this is it, right?
Paul's visit. What happened?
Caroline says, where does Paul write the book? How does this work? Come says, oh, Jesus, Rob, you better get a painting, right? So we got a painting.
So she was worried that Paul Howard was coming to the house.
Yeah.
And so it triggered a renovation.
It's coming to the house.
The Milky Bar gave you.
Throw arms, as they call it. You know about this, Paul. New cushions, everything right. Coffee table. So I put the logs in the fire, and you know, and as Paul said, it was like a Christmas card picture.
So it's like Paul arrives, do like and see Christmas show.
I usher Paul in, and he goes, and he looks at him, and he goes, he says, what's this? This is what we do. We say, now I want to go into the madness in the kitchen. So I said, okay. So Paul gets up to walk into the kitchen and he takes the handle of the door. The handle comes off in his hand.
Oh, no.
It's been broke for years, right? And Paul is the most patient, absolute patient person, right? The most inoffensive man I've ever met in my life. And we're sitting there. And after about 4 visits, Paul goes, Rod, please, will you do something for me? What is it? Will you stop the drip on that tap over there? The drip was in the tap for about 5 years. Right?
Roddy and Caroline's house.
I used to call it a feature.
Roddy and Caroline's house is just a snag list of things waiting to be done, right? Just like the chairs on the floor.
They're having too much crack.
There's a famous story of Roddy's house where he took the door down to use it as a wallpaper and table when he was decorating.
The old days, you know.
He put it back up, but somebody pulled the door and
put it back up. One screw in each hinge fell back down. But then the biggest one, the downstairs toilet, right?
What's going on there?
Now, nobody's to use this, okay? Now, we've 3 adult kids living with us, 17, whatever. Next of all, Paul arrives. That's your toilet, Paul.
Great, it's a personal toilet.
Executive toilet.
Next of
yeah,
all,
yeah.
Paul arrives at 8 o'clock, 10 to 8 one morning at Carnage Shows. He was out there using Paul's toilet.
Me Palm Olive had already been opened.
Special toilet paper. You know the one with the dog on it, the real expensive one.
Four ply toilet paper.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
We'd be queuing up upstairs to the bathroom to use the toilet during the day. Paul be
Mr. Howard's toilet is not paper. To be touched.
But we had, like I said earlier, we 10 hours a day at that kitchen table.
Yeah.
Laughing. Just.
Well, Paul, you want to bring the story to that, and I don't get it with many people. I love Tommy Cooper. I used to laugh at Tommy Cooper. But Paul makes me laugh. Not many people say, and Caroline, God love her, she broke her neck through the book. That's another story. Broke her neck. She was upstairs in a colliery. And she came down one day, 11 o'clock. She says, lads, are you going to write the book? She's going to laugh on day. We used to sit there from early talk till 11. Oh, no, 10 o'clock was the break. And I got introduced to scones.
Scones on the
scones
outside,
with
yeah,
cream
yeah.
and jam and everything.
You got a scone.
But they had to go in the microwave as well.
Roddy put a scone. Roddy thinks a scone needs 7 minutes in the microwave.
Wow.
The thing was just rubble when it came out.
It was like dry field.
Roddy, is that all right? It's a jet, it's fine, Roddy.
No, you're exaggerating. Carolyn said to me, Paul likes his scone in the microwave. Just put it in for 30 seconds. I put it for 3 minutes. I didn't. Next of all, ding, I went and there was this little marble.
So marble.
A little lump hammer to try and soften her
Maria
up.
Burke, Maria in West Cork is saying that she's in the car laughing. She's asking, I hope you come to Cork. Are you going to go on the show on the road after
We'd
the Ambassador?
We'd love to. We did go to Cork. We were in Kinsale with the show just over a year ago. Yeah. We'll bring it on the road. We definitely will. This is the start. You know, we've got the gig in the Ambassador on the 30th of November, and we're doing one in Clonsilla on the 1st of November.
1st November to Clonsilla.
Jerry wants you to go across the Shannon as well. Asking. So
we will. Yeah, we would love to. Like I said earlier, Roddy's managed everywhere, and in many of those places, he's still remembered fondly. Yeah, in several of them.
They'll sing the song, of course. Roddy Collins is a banker, you know.
Yeah.
It sounds like, but come here. Oh, it's just great crack. And you know what I love, Paul? I love it. When you get in the crowd and the laughter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Into the Q&A.
Feel the atmosphere.
Yeah. Here, I can't let you go. We have to go to an ad break. Actually, we'll take the ad break out of the way and I'll ask. I'm so sorry to take ad breaks because they've literally told about four stories during the ad break. The League of Ireland, in 30 seconds, Roddy, which is you're incapable of.
Brilliant.
Who is going to win the League of Ireland? There are four teams, possibly. Technically, five could win it, but it's between Shells, Rovers, St. Pat's, Derry City.
Do you know what? I won't get back against Pat's. They have the best League of Ireland manager. That's ever been in League of Ireland football.
They've
Stephen
won
Kenny.
Five in a row now as well, haven't they?
Yeah, well, no, Rovers, you know, I don't think will win the league. Shells need to get back on track, get themselves back on track. But it's brilliant. But then at the bottom end as well.
It's a
brilliant
real
season for League
season,
of Ireland.
Isn't it?
And
yeah,
the
right
crowds
the
are up.
You've done
Everyone's something to go for.
Bows down at
and
the
it's just, it's been a brilliant season. But, you know, Dover, going to lose sleep, but it doesn't come easy. Winning titles is very difficult.
Damon
strength, mental, psychological for everybody. So the psychological aspect of it is now.
I should say that, you know, with all the laughs we're having and everything, we're talking about Roddy as a comedian, a great raconteur and everything. He won the League of Ireland double. And not many people can say that. You know, his first season at Bowes, he saved them from relegation. Season two got them to a cup final, and season three won the double. And then got sacked.
Well, you know,
no thanks.
But 33 months, I didn't notice. A man rang me, said, Rob, nobody in the world of football has ever taken a team from rock bottom to the division in the Indigenous League to win in a double, ever.
In 33
never.
Months.
So, look, it's hard, Oliver. It's very difficult. This is the hard part.
You were there.
You got to be strong. You got to be strong and stick to your gut feeling.
We're running out of time, but thanks to Philomena, who's had a great time there. It's great. She's in Lusk. They want you to cross Shan. Yes, we've done that one. Would Caroline do an interview to get the real story? Asked Dave and Kilkenny. And people are trapped in their cars, they can't leave. Listen to you.
Caroline won't even get to a photograph.
But they will get it all live and in person. Roddy Collins in conversation with Paul Howard, live at the Ambassador Theatre on Parnell Square in Dublin on the 30th of November, the last day. Tickets on sale now. Thanks a million, lads.
Thanks,
thank
Oliver.
You. And the Clonsilla on the 4th as well.
Oh, the Clonsilla on the 1st of November, yeah.
Important, yeah. Yes. In the safe areas for you.
That's it.
And you're all very welcome back now. Actor David Rawl joins us this morning. You will know David Rawl because he was in the hilarious Moon Boy as Martin Moon. He was the kid and he's before me. He doesn't look like the kid anymore. You are now, what age are you? And it was a birthday.
24.
24 years of age.
As of yesterday.
That puts you into the One Direction thing which we're talking about this morning in sad circumstances, sadly. But you would have been... It would have been right bang smack in the heyday.
Yeah, growing up in the middle of the kind of One Direction mania. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe, to be honest.
No, I know you're a Leitrim lad, so there's a toughness there. But One Direction was the first boy band that was accepted for lads to also enjoy because they were so bold.
definitely. And they had some really, really beautiful songs. And you know what? They were very popular. Maybe you weren't very vocal about being a supporter at the time. Okay. Maybe you rolled your eyes publicly, but privately, you definitely were listening to all the new music.
Do you have sisters in your family?
I do, two older sisters.
But they were definitely fans.
Oh, yeah.
And you pretended you didn't like them to them. No, we're delighted to have you in, David Rawl. 24 years of age now. You're going to be in The Borrowers, which is the winter play this year at the Gay Theatre from the 16th of November. Oh, that's very soon. It's only a month away until the 12th of January. Are you in the rehearsals right now?
We are. We're into week three and it's getting serious. We're trying to get the lines learned off, but it's coming together nicely. It's a beautiful team that they've brought in together and there's a lot of new music that's been written for it by the incredibly talented Fionn Foley, who I genuinely think is a genius. The work work that he's done in this. I mean, I kind of thought that the play would live or die by the music, and hearing it all on the first day, all these incredible people who've worked on the West End, really, really talented singers bringing the music to life, and I was like, this has exceeded every expectation that I could have for it. So I'm really, really excited for people to hear it.
Well, compared to you, I'm an owl flare, right? The Borrowers, the TV, that's like, it feels like it's from my era. And then it was a book for a generation even before that. It's kind of followed along.
Yeah.
To remind people what the story is.
So the story, it was written first in the 1950s by Mary Norton. It's a wonderful series of children's books, and they're kind of classics. But basically, it's about this family of tiny people who live in the walls of this huge house. And they borrow from the human beings who live there. And basically they can't be seen because they're so small. And then what happens to this one family when they're discovered by the human boy who lives there, who I play in this show? And it's a beautiful kind of like for the whole family, to be honest. Like, it's not necessarily a kid's show or for adults. It's kind of for everyone. And it's like a lovely show for Christmas. There's a lot of feel-good moments in it. It's, you know, sometimes there's some scarier moments, but it's overall, it's really joyous.
Did you read the original material?
I did. I only finished the other day. It's absolutely beautiful. Children's books in those days, they were able to put in so much like descriptive language, and like I grew up reading like Captain Underpants and loving it. But I was like, God, in those days, children were well educated.
They were literary.
They were literary.
And so cruel things would happen in stories as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's obviously some baddies in this one as well. But
it felt to me in the day that it was a very English sort of a tale.
Yeah.
And I know The Gate last year had Peter Pan, Roddy Doyle, and he Irished it up. He moved all the action.
Yes.
Back to Dublin. Is it kind of an Irished up version?
We have Irished it up because it's quite universal. Like even their 2010, I think, Studio Ghibli did a version of it called Arrietty, and they had Saoirse Ronan and Tom Holland playing the boy and Arrietty, and so it is kind of it's kind of been adopted by different cultures, and because it is just such a universal story. But yeah, it originated in England and it's kind of been taken over by the rest of the world.
How does it work on stage when you can't shrink members of the cast?
Well, Oliver, you'll have to come and see the show.
Oh, it's
out.
A secret of
them. There will be some technical magic.
Oh, really?
Yes, they will be doing some wonderful projections and things like that. Uh-huh. But I mean, it's the power of imagination, you know.
But you're the kind of the giant.
Yes.
In this compared to
well, technically,
your previous
I play
work.
Two children. I play the boy who finds them, and I also play a wild borrower who they encounter.
Oh, there's
in the
lots
second
of
half.
Trickery going on.
Yeah,
in this
yeah.
Come here. You've been busy over the years, haven't you? Immediately after Moon Boy, because you're a kid fame, do you go back to school? Do you continue acting or what?
Yeah, I kind of made the conscious choice that I was kind of like, I wasn't really interested in giving up school and going off and doing acting full time, because I was kind of like, like I'll just stay in school and I'll get the education.
This is,
and
definitely
I'll,
Leitrim Cam.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll, you know,
what
not
about the panic of stardom? You have to be go into the next things, thrive on.
No, I was like, go get an education, become a normal person, develop, grow. Don't be an idiot. And then I always knew that I wanted to go to college. And for years, I wasn't really sure. Do I want to go into acting? Do I want to go maybe something behind the camera? And then I did a play when I was 16, 17, and I was just like, nah, this is what I want to do. And then,
what age were you when you left the Moon Boy? What was the last
day? I was about 13.
Okay, so you had a couple of years, and then you did a play at 16. What was the play?
I did a play called Or You Or, Rossum's Universal Robots, which we did in the Peacock as part of the National Youth Theatre. 16 young people from across Ireland from different youth theatres. We ended up living together for 5 weeks in Dublin, putting on a play, and it was the first time that I kind of was part of that world in real way, and it was just an amazing experience. It made me go, I want to do this, I want to get better at it, and I want to learn more.
You got the grow for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you would have had the grow as a kid, or can you have it when you're that young?
It doesn't feel like work when you're a kid. Like, it's anything's better than school, and this was it was kind of like a playground every day, and they'd give you a few lines and you'd say those and you make people laugh, and it was such funny material. It didn't feel like a job. And then you get older, you kind of think, yeah, but what do I actually enjoy? And it was kind of only kind of going, I feel so lucky that I found the thing that I love doing almost by accident.
Yeah.
And now I get to do that.
That's how it happens.
Yeah.
It? You dabble in something.
Yeah,
it becomes
exactly.
your life.
Yeah.
So you were, what, 11 years of age when
11,
you were cast?
Yeah.
Was there a big,
yeah.
long, difficult process? Because it was a famous star from the west of Ireland coming over to make a show about his own childhood.
Yeah, I
in
think,
Roscommon.
I mean, I was from that area, from Leitrim, from Carrigaline, and they were looking for... The description was an idiot boy from the west of Ireland, and they were like, well, I know one. And yeah, basically just did an audition. I was like, I'll audition for the smaller part because obviously I'm not going to get the lead.
You didn't even go for that?
No, okay. I was like, why would I bother? And then next thing you know, would you come back for the second round and go for the lead? I was like, that must have been the wrong number, but anyway, I'll go in. And did that, went grand. Third round, it's down to you and two other guys. I'm like, well... Okay, good luck to one
I'm
of them.
About to lose now.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, now I'm invested.
Leitrim in the college championship.
But well, thankfully, a little bit more successful than that. And it ended up working out. They offered me the part, and I had the most beautiful, happy, enjoyable experience. Wow. And I look back on it. And
when did you first meet Chris O'Dowd?
At the third round audition.
Oh, really?
But I was kind of a little bit too young to... I hadn't watched Bridesmaids at that stage. So I hadn't watched the IT
God.
Crowds. You know, I was still getting through Captain Underpants. So I wasn't... I became a fan of his work. Yeah. But at that time, I think it was lovely kind of starting off on an even keel of kind of going, neither of us know who the other one is.
He's a big supporter of yours, isn't he?
Ah, yes.
And likewise,
fair.
Of course. You've since watched Bridesmaids.
I have since watched Bridesmaids.
And all the unquotable, unbroadcast.
But I, what was really, really lovely was that I got to work with him again recently,
yeah.
only in the last year. His new TV show, Small Town Big Story, which should be out in February on Sky. And he's written it, and he's directed some of it, and he...
I read about it, some of this a few months ago, which
yeah.
I think is it's a big Hollywood production coming into Ireland. Is that
That's
story?
It. Okay. It's a bit meta. But yes, yeah, so this huge Hollywood production, kind of like a Game of Thrones type things, comes to this tiny little village on the border.
Great
Ireland,
idea, yeah.
And brings up all of these secrets that have been tried to be hidden in the town. And I play the doctor's son, played by Paddy Considine, who is an absolute legend.
Oh, go away.
It was just an incredible cast of people and a really, really wonderful thing to be a part of. And yeah, kind of like a comedy drama. I'm excited for people to see it.
It kind of highlights how you managed to bridge that impossible gap of being the child star and then coming back as an adult.
I don't worry too much about that.
but it is a thing, isn't it? It doesn't,
oh, no,
doesn't work
absolutely.
For very many.
Absolutely. I think, definitely. I knew that I was more interested in being an actor than in being a star or in being, you know...
I'm
so much more interested in the work and what I'm doing next and the characters and who I get to work with rather than worrying about all the nonsense that kind of surrounds it.
To pick up the story then where you were talking about... You left at 13, 16 you do the play. So now you decided what you want to do in college.
Yeah, exactly. And at that time when I was doing the play, a lot of people were talking about drama school, which had seemed like a very alien notion because for film actors, you know, when people say when you go to drama school, you can't work for 3 years. And I said, how could I do that, darling? And then when I actually was kind of getting to that age, I was 18 and I suddenly realised that that's actually kind of the best way of doing it and actually just being within that bubble of kind of being able to fail safely every day and for it not to be, you know, on camera forever.
The lovies.
Yeah, exactly,
but you put
exactly.
It in a much nicer
the lovies, exactly. The delicate actor people. And I think that was exactly what I needed.
What a Leitrim man thrown in among them.
Exactly,
so shook
exactly.
Up, shook up the sheep. When you are a kid in school and you're in this massive show that everyone in the country and in Britain has seen and beyond, what's it like then going back to school after that?
Like grand. I mean, it was kind of, I didn't really let on hugely. If people asked, I was like, oh yeah, I did a bit of filming, and they went, right, sure. Because it kind of sounds too good to be true. I mean, it sounds unrealistic. So most people just probably assumed that I was sick or something.
David from first year, he was a wee kid. I haven't seen him in a while.
Haven't seen him in an awful long time. But and then you just kind of get on with it. And then when it was coming out, people were like, did you do that thing? And you go, yeah. And they go, all right, Grant, must give it a watch. And then you just kind of get on with
She's
it.
Very together around Leitrim. I must look up, is there a Valium factory over there? Some the fumes seem to come drift across.
We're just level-headed people. Okay?
Walking around with zero notions. You'll have to develop the notion somehow along the way. That was a lovely experience that you didn't have. anyone sort of thinking you had notions and you didn't think you had notions?
I mean, there was like, you know, maybe, you know, 15, 20 people in my entire class in national school, and then, you know, going into secondary school, and there was maybe 200 people there in all, you know, very, very small. You already knew everybody.
Which was the best place in the country, isn't it?
Well, you heard it here first, folks.
Well, we don't tell them.
Yeah, the secret's out.
They will absolutely destroy
it's going to be
place.
Mobbed.
But you weren't into sport or anything like that. It was,
no.
And there's a great Amdram scene anyway.
There is, there, and I'm very lucky in Carrigallen. There's a lovely little theatre, the Cornmill, and it's got a huge tradition of Amdram. They've won the All-Ireland 3 times, and so I'd always been growing up watching some great shows, and definitely it's massively a part of the community.
Another bonus for you is you get to walk around and no one says, there's the kid from, there's the Moon Boy. Because happily, you know, you've changed quite a bit.
Yes, yes, thankfully.
I tried to say it politely. You're unrecognisable.
I know, it's kind of great. Yeah. It's kind of great. You know, it never got too overwhelming. And again, it's a lovely thing when people are coming over to you for something that's positive and wanting to tell you how much they enjoyed the experience of watching something that you were a small part of. And that is a really, really beautiful thing. And, you know, and now the lovely thing is that people have maybe a special memory of it, and that when they want to talk about it, that they remember watching it with their granny, or they remember watching it with, and that can be a really, really nice thing. But it's, yeah,
you don't want to do things, then it will give you the whole selfie world, basically. It could happen after next year when this was a small town big story.
Yes.
So the Lear is where you go to the Lear Academy. Yeah. We were speaking to Ellie Lilly Highland only
recently. Yes,
she was ahead of you, I think, on the
2 years ahead of me. Fantastic actress. There was absolute superstars.
She's very calm as well.
Oh my god, totally.
The Lear.
She's from Carlow. Ah, she's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. She's a good part of the world. And how did you get on there then?
Grand. I mean, I loved it. I was part of a great year. But, you know, they're incredible tutors. It's a really, really fantastic place. We're lucky to have like training of that calibre in Ireland. And it's only recently enough, I think, it opened in 2011 or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's already done incredible work. And I had a really, really positive experience there.
You did really heavy stuff coming out of, or were you in the Lear when you played the part of Brendan O'Donnell? That film.
That was, I think I was 15 when I played.
Oh, sorry, okay.
That was a dark one.
See, the years doesn't seem very long ago.
I know.
But you have done these heavier roles along the way.
Yeah.
Is that important to keep the variety of?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, comedy is one of the hardest things you can do, but I mean, you know, you can't really do it unless you can do tragedy as well. And, you know, I think being able to do...
I missed that note. Well, I suppose I'm an RT, just kind of part tragedies. Okay, so The Borrowers is going to be the thing. Are there other things beyond that? This is always difficult to ask an actor.
There are other things beyond that, which people will see in the future.
Oh, you're yes.
Yes.
I have a note that I'm not allowed to say. Why would I even? I don't know the thing.
there will be more things anon.
But we look forward to seeing the next Chris O'Dowd thing.
Yes.
I love the fact that you're working again together.
I know. It was really, really special because, I mean, it had been 10 years since we'd worked together properly. Yeah. And obviously we kept in touch a bit. But to be working together with somebody that you really love and admire and just have had so many positive experiences with after
so
long.
I really hope he makes it someday.
I know. I know. I'm praying for him.
Comes back here and starts hanging out with Jessica Chastain. And all this, you know. The Borrower, starring David Rawl, opens at the Gay Theatre on the 16th of November, runs until the 12th of January. gate-theatre.ie for all the information. But you won't be able to miss, I think, they do excellent marketing for that.
They do.
Feel good play. David Rawl, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Up Leitrim and all that goes with it, and enjoy all that you do. We'll talk to you for the next big thing that you're not allowed to mention now. Okay. In 1985, this man, he was offered a place at both human and veterinary medical schools on the same day. He chose a course for his life to care for animals. Now he is the super vet, really well known from the Channel 4 series and his best-selling books. And he's on a new mission to celebrate dogs and their humans. Originally from County Leash, now based in his world-class animal clinic in Surrey, England. A warm welcome, Noel Fitzpatrick.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
Very well, thank you very much. And I feel the warm, cuddly glow from I haven't got the whole book, but I've dipped in and out here and there. And it's a gorgeous thing. It's called Dogs and Their Humans. Isn't that what that's what you went for?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I think Well, the intention, Oliver, is to spread a little bit of love in the world, and I see that every day through dogs and their humans in my consulting room. So I just wanted to radiate that out into the world and hope that people find that light too.
You like to say and tell us that dogs make us better humans. How?
That's a great question, Oliver. Aren't you the insightful reviewer?
I could do this in project.
I think that humans allow us a safe space. They allow us a space within ourselves where we can be ourselves. There are many stories in the book about rock stars, royalty, and people who are very, 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 very far from that.
Yeah.
But regardless of who you are, you're still stooping down to pick up the poo. You're still feeding them. You're still having their tongue lick your ear. And they don't care who you are. They care what you are. They care what you are inside. They care, are you kind? Are you generous? Are you giving? Are you in the present? Are you being of yourself in that moment? And I think that it is in the essence of our true selves that we become our best if we allow ourselves to be our best. And in those moments, we are. So in that sense, that's why I think dogs make us the best version of ourselves.
And you talk about the unconditional love. Those of us who have known and felt this love will hold it inside us forever, so much so that a dog isn't just home, a dog is home.
Yes. Yeah, I think that in my life, I have seen people suffering from terrible diseases, mental and physical. I've seen people down on their luck. I've seen people going through all phases of life. And more than once, in fact, many times in my career, I have faced life or death decisions most days. I mean, I'm in my practice now, and downstairs there are life and death decisions being made right now. And nearly everybody, the essence of why they're here to see me is hope. And what they often say to me is, I want to go home. In the generic sense of home is where the heart is. Home is where that love is. And for pretty much everybody that comes into my clinic, home is where their dog is.
Tell us about Kira.
Ah, yes. Well, I'm in my office in rural Surrey in England, looking out across a garden towards a small white gravestone on which her name is written. So she has passed. But has she? I see her light every day. I think that if love is strong enough, it transcends space and time. And I don't think that we die if we can fall in love forever. So Kira was the love of my life. She was a little border terrier who kept me company for 14 years through the ups and downs building of the practice. As you said in your intro, you know, I came from a farming community in Ireland of which I'm intensely proud, and I am very emotionally still connected and earth is to the animals and to my origins in Ireland. And Kira reflected every part of my life, all of those origins and all of the future. And the future for me has been to try and build the best world I can for animals, because I think we owe them a fair deal in return for all they give to us. And after all, we're all in it together. So Kira was my best friend, my confidant, and we were in life together, side by side.
I mean, just the way you describe her in the book is just an extraordinarily gorgeous tribute. The dog, she was 14 years, she was killed actually on the grounds of your clinic.
So what happened was, unfortunately, a delivery van came into the yard too fast and hit her as I was just literally walking from my office to my car.
God.
And it was intensely traumatic, because she was my best friend in the whole wide world. But actually, no, she lived a year after that. We operated on her twice. She had major internal injuries and major skeleton injuries. And to be honest with you, Oliver, it's quite something when you have to step up to the plate to operate on your best friend, because I trained my whole life for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And her life was in my hands, 1 millimeter false move and she was dead. And we did save her on that occasion, right. And she lived another 11 months and then unfortunately had a cardiac arrest. And again, it's quite something when your best friend has a heart attack to cut down on their chest and massage their heart and feel their heart passing beneath the touch of your finger. But it does put you in touch with something that is eternal and ethereal and something that transcends our normal everyday worries. And what I would like to say to people through this book, Dogs and Their Humans, is that when we're in the presence of that unconditional love, the love where a dog doesn't judge us and allows us to be in a safe space to be ourselves, regardless of our mental, physical state, whatever, that's an incredible connection to why we are human at all.
Yeah.
And what Kira has taught me is how to be humble, how to be kind, how to be at peace. And in many ways, she saved my life in that regard, regardless of the stresses of life. There's always that love to be at home with.
And this is primarily, I presume, why you don't use the term dog owner.
Yes. I don't believe you can own love. You wouldn't say, well, I own my girlfriend, my boyfriend, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's always been like that. It's just the way I see the world. I have said dogs and their humans as a little bit of irony because they don't see it that way either. You're their companion. I am her companion. Right now, I have a giant Maine Coon cat called Excalibur on my knee, and he is my friend. And Ricochet is the other cat who is sitting here beside me, and he's like, Dada, why are you not rubbing my belly, and
that's
why are you talking
name.
To this fella?
Ricochet.
Yes.
Is it advisable to get another dog when you love that deeply the one that has passed?
I would say yes. Hmm. But I haven't been brave enough, to be honest with you, Oliver, because I have felt so deeply emotionally for Kira. I haven't yet been brave enough. And also, I would say, as I say in the book, it's the greatest blessing that I have had in my life. And I would encourage people to have it in their lives. But also, a dog is a responsibility. I know it's a cliche that a dog is forever and not for Christmas. I totally agree with that. But because you need to take a dog for a walk. And let me tell you, Oliver, if I'm in theater for 10 hours, a dog will have his legs crossed trying to wait for a pee. And I would need help to do that. So if you're taking on a dog, you need to make sure that you can give them what they need in their life. And then I can assure you, you will get what you need in your life 1 million times over.
Wow. The work you do is astonishing. You're called a super vet for a reason. And the procedures, the surgeries that you kind of describe in this story, they're cutting edge, aren't they? They're world class.
Yeah. So this book is supposed to be a book anyone can read. Anyone who knows me, who's read my three previous memoirs, can just skip the introduction and go straight to chapter one, because I think it's very funny. Now, you'll be the judge of funniness, because I'm not. But you are. So I would encourage people to read. The first few chapters are actually, I think, very funny. They made me laugh when I was writing them, let's say. But I also wanted to weave into the 300 or so pages of the book messages that mattered. I say a lot about what I think about the state of medicine in the world, what I said about a fair deal for animals, what I feel about my profession, what I feel about the juxtaposition, the tug of war between money and delivery of service. I say quite a lot about that. I've striven to stay independent all my life, and I've striven to develop procedures that will elevate the bar and make things better for animals, because I do not believe that they should be giving us the solutions for our illnesses through implants and drugs in research when they don't get it themselves.
Yeah.
I do not believe that that's fair. That's the concept of one medicine to which I have dedicated my life through my charity, Humanimal Trust. Anyway, to answer your point, yes, there is woven into those stories the solutions which we have found, some of which are comical.
We'll talk about Frankie. Tell us about Frankie, who was very ill when Frankie was brought in. Frankie's a little Westie.
Yeah, was Frankie the one with the neck problem?
The belt that was inside. There was a suspender belt.
My goodness, you're launching straight in with that?
Well, you said
you're a brave man.
People would enjoy the funny stories at the start. So I said, yes, we've talked about the cutting edge and the belt.
All right, listen, I'll put it in terms of as politely as I can, shall I, Oliver?
Yeah, sure, look, we're grown-ups here. We've given them fair warning now. Go on.
We've given them fair warning. All right. So this is a great... You're quite right. So, good pick. Yeah. So Frankie was a Westie that came in to see me when I started out in practice here in the UK. I wasn't long here. I was still cutting my teeth. Was feeling, you know, pretty raw. I mean, I come from large animal practice in Ireland. Didn't know that much. But a dog from West Highland White Terrier came in trying to puke, trying to reach up something, trying to get it out. Yeah. And came in a Bentley, a very expensive car. A very well-dressed lady stepped out of that car holding Frankie, and her rather haughty and aloof husband stepped out beside her, screaming for a vet he was, and she was very polite and timid, and the poor dog was trying to vomit up something, so I said to him, look, I'm going to have to make him puke. So I made him puke, and the West Highland White Terrier on the garden in front of the practice brought up a red suspender belt.
Hey.
At which moment, his wife turned to him and said, that's not mine, George. And divorce happened within seconds. So the haughty man was rapidly brought to his knees by his canine friend.
Oh, there's nothing like the truth of animals. Sure. We're going to take a quick break now. There's loads of messages coming in. I'm going to get to them very, very quickly after this. And you're welcome back. We're still here with Noel Fitzpatrick, the super vet. Noel, we have lovely messages from around the place. I'll give you this one from Joan. Noel and his oncology team saved my dog Cookie when nobody in Ireland could help him. Cookie became the first Irish dog to undergo prostatic embolization in 2019. He gave us another glorious year of life with Cookie. We will be forever grateful.
Oh, that's very kind and very nice. Thank you.
Because it's all about that time, isn't that what people ask you for all the time? Just a little bit more. Just a little bit more.
Yeah, well, as well as that, Oliver, in all honesty, it's not enough to be able to do something. It needs to be the right thing to do. So I do talk about this a bit in the book. Amid all those funny stories, I talk about ethics and morals and when is the right time to say goodbye and when is the right time to fight for life.
And you have years of experience to judge on it. Noel, you speak the truth. We lost our darling Tilly some years ago. The connection she had with our daughter Abby was truly profound. Then we got Beauty, who passed 2 years ago. And my Welsh husband, I've never seen cry so much and swore he'd never get another dog. We got Sheba 18 months ago. And oh boy, so much love again. Animals give unconditional love. Thank you, Noel. And that's from Maria in West Cork.
That's very kind. I started out in West Cork in Dunmanway, so shout out to Dave Smith and his family down there because they gave me a great start in terms of training. I've never worked with people who have been more in tune with animals than down in West Cork, so that's wonderful.
Dunmanway, the home of Sam Maguire. I'm sitting outside my car, outside the dog groomers as our Westie Chelsea is getting groomed. She's 15 years old, the epitome of unconditional love from Tommy in Selbridge. That's a big age now, isn't it? Maybe not for that breed.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, Oliver, coming through and what you'll find in these messages is this bond. If you talk, a lot of people don't talk about it very much, but if you do talk about this bond of love, people who haven't felt it are like, well, you know, it's a dog and so on. And I get that. I understand that. But, you know, we're just human beings. And what is it that makes us tick? Well, love. Home, something to go home to, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of joy, a sense of fun in our lives. Dogs bring all of that, all of it into our world. And as is self-evident from your messages, that is what people are connecting to. And that's what this book is supposed to delve into and rummage around in and raise up and have it edified in our presence. Because it is a wonderment. It's a wonderful thing.
There's also someone looking for advice here, Noel. Our dog is barking constantly during the day, middle of the night and so on. He's never done this before. The vet thinks he may have dementia and we have to have the conversation about putting him down. Is there any solution? Asks Finian.
So, interestingly, Oliver, I get this a lot and people, so with total respect, I am not a behaviourist, but I do talk about behaviour issues in the book in the sense of we see them all the time. What I would say to that dear person is if it's appropriate, ask their vet for an MRI scan of the brain if they think that that is really appropriate. There's a story in my book about a Pomeranian called Bertie, and her mum, Bertie's mum, Cynthia, came to see me. And Bertie, she thought, was going to have to be put to sleep because he was screaming in pain all the time. And it turned out she'd rolled over on Bertie in the bed. And Bertie hated her, and she didn't know why Bertie hated her. And in the end, it turned out to be a problem in the neck that was fixable. And the only question she had for me wasn't, how complex is the surgery going to be and all? How much is the risk? It was, will Bertie ever love me again? So fortunately, he did.
Surgery. He did. Okay, that's the happy ending. A serious question indeed. Here. What is your view on killer dogs, asks Michael in Dublin 12.
Yeah, so again, I get asked all of these things in interviews, and I guess to try and put yourself in the position of a human orthopedic neurosurgeon, it's not a question that a human orthopedic neurosurgeon could answer. It's a question that a legislator would be answering. So I always got to steer clear of that because I'm not a legislator. I'm an orthopedic neurosurgeon, sadly.
And the laws have just changed recently on XL bully dogs, as we know, and that story has been well trod. Look, it's a lovely, uplifting tale, and you just want that sort of message to go out, don't you, to people?
Yes. Yeah, you know, the chapters in the book are about doing the right thing. They're about taking the lead. I particularly like those kinds of stories where a dog takes the lead with a guy who has lost himself, where there's a rock star in the book that falls down on his luck, and the chapter's called More Than Everything because his girlfriend showed him through the dog that, in fact, there was something more than everything that he had thought he had become. And there's stories in there about the Queen and all of that stuff that I think people will relate
there's
to.
There's loads and loads of entertainment. I love it towards the end where you say, I hope this book reminds us all of how lucky we are to share our lives with dogs. They tell us daily that we are enough just as we are. Noel Fitzpatrick, it's been a pleasure. Dogs and
Thank
their humans.
Thank you so much, Oliver.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dogs and Their Humans is the book that you'll enjoy whether you're into dogs. And if you're not, we don't understand you, basically. Sure, where else would you get it? Roddy Collins, Messing in German Diplomacy, Moon Boy Turned Leitrim Leading Man, and How Dogs Will Save Your Life. It's the end of the podcast, as you know it. If you've interesting stories, things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an email anytime at all. Oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you. Slán.